hotel. You were thinner than I'd imagined. I'd expected a little belly, maybe. I don't know why. Hello, he said at my approach, as though someone had just plugged you in and switched you on. Hello. You wouldn't have known how nervous I was. You wouldn't have guessed. I played it very, very cool. Hello, I replied, my hands tight around my dog-eared copy of your book. I have my own copy. Would you mind signing it for me? I pass it across to you and you smile that smile you have. The one that makes your eyes into fireworks that go bang, bang, bang in my soul. Well, you said, that is a well-loved copy. I could have told you I'd read it 30 times. I could have told you that your book made me laugh more in a week than I'd laughed in the year before I read it. I could have told you that I was completely in awe of you. But I wanted you to see me as an equal. So I simply said, it has been a very useful tool. I'm a math tutor. Well, you said, I am very glad to hear that. You took the book from me and held your pen over the title page. Shall I sign it to you? Yes, I said. Please. Noel. Noel, you said. That's a lovely name. Were you a Christmas baby? Yes. December the 24th. Best Christmas present ever, eh? No, I replied. Apparently not. Apparently, I ruined Christmas Day for everyone. You laughed then. I hadn't imagined a laugh for you. In your photo, you looked as if you might go so far as a chuckle, if tickled to the point of no return. But no, you had a proper laugh where your mouth opened wide, and your head tipped back in your neck, and a big thunderclap boom exploded from you. I liked it. Very much. You wrote something after my name. I wanted to see what it was, but I didn't want to look as though I cared. You're American, I said. To a certain extent, you said. And you're Irish. Yes, to the fullest possible extent. You liked my little joke, and you laughed again. It felt like someone massaging the inside of my stomach with velvet-gloved hands. Where are you from? Near Dublin, I replied. County Wicklow, where all the sheep live. He laughed for a third time, and I felt emboldened in a way I'd never felt before in my life. I looked behind me to check that a queue hadn't built as we talked. But I still had you all to myself. Are you here again tomorrow? I asked. No. No. They're putting me on a train back to London after this. Which leaves in... Oh. You looked at your watch. Approximately 2 hours. I should probably be wrapping this up soon. Have you signed many books? Oh, yeah. Hundreds and hundreds. You clicked the lid back on your pen and gave me a sideways smile. Kidding, you said. About 20. Long way to come to sign 20 books. I tend to agree with you. You slid the pen into your jacket pocket and turned away from me, looking about for a person to whisk you away, no doubt. Well, I said. I'll let you get away. I hope you have a safe journey back to London. Whereabouts do you live? North London. Oh, I said. An Oscar-worthy moment of fakery. Snap. So do I. Oh, you said. Whereabouts? Stroud Green. Well, well, what a coincidence. Me too. What? You live in Stroud Green? This I had not known. This I could never have believed to be possible. Yes. Latimer Road, do you know it? Yes, I said, joy virtually pouring out of my ears and my eyeballs and my nostrils. Yes, I do know it. I'm just a few roads down from you. Well, well, well. Maybe our paths will cross again then. Yes, I'd said, as though it would be no more than a fun coincidence if they did. Not the culmination of all my hopes and worldly dreams. Maybe they will. 2 weeks later, they did. Chapter 28. To say that I'd been stalking you would be an overstatement. We lived but 200 feet apart after all. It would be fair, though, to say that I was going out a little more than I usually tended to. Coming upon a nearly empty bottle of milk in the fridge would fill me with delight. Oh dear, I shall have to visit the corner shop again. And if I returned, to the realization that I should also have bought a newspaper while I was out. Well, that really wasn't the end of the world. On with the coat, back to the high street, one eye open for you in one direction, another eye open for you in the other. And anything that gave me cause to pass the end of Latimer Road was a particular bonus. And then one evening, there you were, in the convenience store in a blue anorak and jeans, a bottle of red wine hanging from your fist, studying the breakfast cereals intently. I said, Floyd Dunn. You turned and you remembered me immediately. I knew you did. I hadn't expected that. No one ever remembered me immediately. But you smiled and you said, I know you. You were at the NEC. Yes, I was, indeed. Noel. I gave you my hand and you shook it. Noel. Of course. The unwanted Christmas present. How are you? I'm truly grand, thank you. And you? I am moderately grand, if that's possible. Oh yes, I said. There are many shades of grand. There was a small moment then, I recall. It was likely awkward, though I'd be hard-pressed to judge as my whole life until this point had been vaguely awkward. But you stepped into the moment and saved it. And that was when I knew. You said, and I shall never, ever forget this because it was so remarkable to me. You said, Rice Krispies or mini shredded wheats. Which may not sound like much of anything, but it was what it wasn't that was so important to me. It wasn't a rebuttal. It wasn't a glance at your watch and, oh, is that the time? I better get on. It wasn't a suggestion that I was taking up too much of your life, that I was somehow blocking your view of better things. It was an invitation to banter. So of course I seized it. Rice Krispies, I said, are delicious. But 5 minutes later, you're hungry again. All that air. You smiled. I liked your crooked teeth. All that air, you repeated. You are funny. No, I'm just Irish. True, he said. You do have a natural inbuilt advantage when it comes to humor, so. You turned back to the breakfast cereals. 7-year-old girl. Mother is the health freak. So no sugary stuff. What would you choose? 7-year-old girl. Well, there'd been no mention of a 7-year-old girl in your biography. I can't say I was too fond of small girls. Is this your daughter we're talking about?
Yes. Sarah. Her mother and I recently separated and now I'm a weekend dad. So I can't afford to make any mistakes. My wife already thinks I'm going to leave my daughter somewhere or let her put her hand in a food blender. That kind of thing.
Weetabix then, I said. It has the least sugar of all the cereals. Your face softened and you smiled again.
See,
he said. I knew you'd know about things like that.
I knew you would. Do you have children of your own?
No, not even vaguely. You looked at me then, and I could tell you were wondering whether or not to say something. Something in particular. I acted like I wasn't fussed, and whatever it was, you decided against saying it. I could see you swallowing the words back into yourself.
Well, you've been most helpful. Thank you, Noel.
You picked up the Weetabix. And that was that. But it was enough so that the next time I bumped into you, a week later, we had a little open-ended thing going on. A little rapport. We chatted about the weather a bit then. And the next time, we chatted about some government scheme to ruin all the schools, which we'd both read about in the papers that morning. It was the fourth time, a month after the education show, that she said,
Have you ever tried that Eritrean place? By the tube?
As it happens. No, I have not.
Well, it is excellent. I've been going there for years. You should try it. In fact.
And there it came. Your invitation to dinner. Yes, Floyd. Your invitation to dinner. I know you will try to twist this and rewrite it, like you try to twist and rewrite everything. But you know, and I know, that you started this. You saw me, Floyd. You saw me and you wanted me. You asked me to dinner. You turned up at that dinner on time and smartly dressed. You did not look at me and say, This has been a terrible mistake, and do a runner. You smiled when I walked in. You stood. You took my shoulders, and you pressed your face against my face. You said,
You look lovely.
You waited until I'd sat down before you sat down. You maintained a steady line of eye contact. You did. You totally, totally did. And then it was you. You phoned me a few days later. Just long enough to make me sweat. Just long enough to make me think about calling you first, but I did not. I did not. And you invited me to your house. Yes, you did. Your goal was clear that night. You wanted to fuck me. But that was okay because I wanted to be fucked by you. I didn't care that dinner was somewhat perfunctory. What was it now? Pasta, I think, with some kind of shop-bought sauce that must have taken you all of 5 minutes to throw together. What a nice bottle of wine, if I recall. And we ended up on your sofa. An hour later, and while you were pulling at my clothes and panting all over me, I said, Believe it or not, I am a virgin, possibly the last one in existence. And you were very kind about it. You didn't laugh or say, you're taking the piss. You didn't recoil or sigh or tell me to go home. You were kind. You touched me all over until I was a blob. And then you were slow and patient. And it did hurt. Yes, it really did. But I've been expecting that. And frankly, you weren't the biggest boy in the class, if you know what I mean. A blessing, really. And I knew. I think I really did know from that point on that you and I were mainly about sex. And that was fine with me. But I grew accustomed to you over the months. Grew accustomed to your pillows and your cereal bowls. The smell of your scalp before you had a shower.
the sight of your name on my phone when you called or texted. You inhabited a big chunk of my life. Over 30%, if we're going to talk in numbers. And probably 30% of that 30% was sex. The rest was just lying in your bed, listening to you shower, waiting for your calls, watching you cook, watching you eat, sitting on your sofa watching TV with you, meals out from time to time, walks in the park from time to time, making arrangements to meet. That's a lot of shared existence for two people in a sex-based relationship. A lot of time not having sex. More than enough time for a bond to form. I never told you I loved you. You never told me you loved me. Some people would say that was sufficient grounds to diminish everything else that happened between us. But I disagree. I disagree very strongly. Chapter 29. I first met Sarah Jade when you and I had been together for a year. Up until then, she'd only been spending every other weekend at yours, and it was easy to keep us compartmentalized. But then your ex got a job, and suddenly she was dropping Sarah on your doorstep all the time, quite often at short notice, quite often when you'd already invited me over for the evening. Well, you told me that she was a difficult girl. She'd responded badly to the split, so you said. And like I said, I'd never really liked little girls. They have a way of looking at you sometimes, as though their hearts are full of hate. And Sarah Jade, she barely looked human. Skin so thin and pale you could see the veins of her. And this shock of white hair. Not blonde, no. White, like an old lady. She was tiny too. More like a 5-year-old than an 8-year-old. I tried to be nice. I really did. You know that. You were there. Remember? Ah, so you must be Sarah Jade. It is a pleasure to meet you. I tried to shake her hand. I always do that with young children because you never know whether they're the kind to appreciate adult attention or not. Some children thrive on it. Their eyes find you and they reel you in. Look at me. Find me impressive. Tell me that I'm better than all the other children. Others could not give a sideways shit and just want to get away from you as fast as they humanly could. So I find that a handshake is a good compromise between fussing over them and ignoring them. And sometimes you'll find you're the very first person to shake their hand. And that's a nice thing, however you look at it. Sarah Jade did not take my hand. She turned and ran from the room, sobbing. Jesus Christ. You ran after her, and I heard your voices and stood there in your hallway, my hand hanging heavy at my side. I felt like a monster. I remember looking at myself in the mirror that hung on your wall there, above the table by your door. I'd begun to look fondly upon myself at that point. I'd begun to focus on the positive, rather than negative. If a man like you wanted to touch me, to behold me, then surely I could not be quite so bad. But the face in the mirror that day, as you soothed your sobbing girl behind a closed door somewhere, it was not a face I wanted to look at. I saw the darkness around my eyes, the pull of my skin away from my cheekbones and toward my chin, the hair that had dulled to rusty water grown too long for my face. I was not pretty. I was not. Your daughter reminded me of that. After that, well, it was hard to like her. After that, for quite some time, it was hard to like myself. I should not have taken it personally. I can see that now. Sarah Jade was a highly strung child, scared of many things, not just the woman in her hallway. But I did take it personally, and I could not bring myself to be kind to that child ever again. To be fair, You found her hard work yourself. She was an aloof child and prone to the most terrible, terrible tantrums. Tantrums is barely the word for it. If I'd been that way inclined, I might have theorized that she'd been possessed by the devil. She threw things. She broke things. She screamed that she wanted to kill you and stab you and cut off your head with a knife. She hated you. Oh, God, yes, she hated you. Other times, she'd be regressive and needy. Make you accompany her to the toilet because she was scared to go on her own. Make you sit outside her room singing a particular song until she was asleep. Sometimes for over half an hour. We spoke about her a lot during those months. Muttered softly across your pillows at night. Wondered what to do and how to deal with it. I had nothing to offer. I knew nothing about small children. I had 1,000 nieces and nephews back home, but I hadn't seen one of them. Not even vaguely interested. But I made the right noises. What about therapy? I suggested. Have you thought about that? But no. Apparently, Kate. Perfect little Kate. The world's most annoying ex-wife. I'm sorry, Floyd, but she was. And you know she was. With that breathy voice. Her baby doll eyes. The way her chin would drop when you told her about Sarah Jade's misdemeanors and she'd say, Oh, Jadey Wadey, poor little sugar bum. Has Daddy been putting you to bed too late again? Christ. I wanted to slice her in half, I really did. No. Kate wasn't having any of it. Too much sugar, not enough sleep, hard week at school, blah, blah, blah. She couldn't see that her own child was a virtual sociopath. But I should have tried harder. I should have been nicer. And if there's any shame of the blame that I'll take, it'll be that. I turned you against her. I did. We demonized her. The pair of us. We bonded over our mutual dismay. Our mutual powerlessness. And the more you turned against her, the more you turned toward me. I became the normal. I became the sane. And I embraced the new dynamic. 100%. And now, Floyd Dunn. Now look at me. Look me in the eye and tell me it wasn't you. Go on. I dare you. Tell me it wasn't you who said it first. Who turned to me in the bed one night, after we'd made love, and took both of my hands inside yours. Who kissed those hands hard and long and said, Maybe if you and I had a child, maybe it would like me. Chapter 30 Laurel drives straight from King's Cross to Hannah's flat, and she cleans her flat harder than she's ever cleaned it before. When there's nothing left to clean, she goes into Hannah's horrible back garden with its stench of disappointing summers, and she hacks everything off with a pair of pruning shears, leaving behind blackened arboreal skeletons and mud and a rusty barbecue that Hannah has never used. She doesn't wear gloves, and afterward, her hands are ripped and raw. But she doesn't care. She rubs some of Hannah's hand cream into her hands and enjoys the rasp of it as it seeps into her flesh. There are no flowers today. But frankly, Laurel no longer cares about her daughter's secret love life. Let her have a secret love life. Let her have a girlfriend, a boyfriend, an old man, a young woman, two young women, and a dog for all she cares. Let her have whom she wants. Hannah will tell her when Hannah is ready. All the things that had seemed important yesterday are important no longer. All that matters now is for Laurel to massage the essence out of the huge knot of new information that is currently blocking up her mind. It's all tangled together, and she's sure it all means something, but it's so unlikely and so bizarre that she cannot find the place to start. She tucks Hannah's £30 into her purse, locks Hannah's flat behind her, gets back into her car, and drives home fast. Typing Noelle Donnelly into Google doesn't offer her much to work with. The world is surprisingly full of Noelle Donnellys, and Laurel is sure that if Noelle had deliberately disappeared and then come back to life as a physiotherapist in Chicago, she wouldn't be shouting to the world about it all over the internet. She types in Noelle Donnelly Math Tutor. This bears more fruit. A few listings on sites with names like findmytutor.com and myperfecttutor.com. But in all cases, the listings have run dry, and there are no new testimonials. She tries Noelle Donnelly Ireland. There are many, but none of them are her Noelle. Finally, she tries Noelle Donnelly Disappearance. The world, she concludes half an hour later, did not care much about the disappearance of Noelle Donnelly. No one seemed to notice. There is nothing. She shuts down her laptop and scratches at her wrists. She tries to recall who recommended Noelle to her in the first place. It was a neighbor. She can see the woman's face. She can see her dogs, a pair of Irish setters, always jumping up at her, leaving muddy paw prints on her jeans. But she cannot remember her name. She goes to the wardrobe in the spare room, and she pulls out a box of things she still hasn't unpacked from the house move. In here, she hopes, is her old address book, a relic from the days when people had address books, when you wrote numbers down instead of typing them into a phone. She finds it halfway and flicks through the pages, feeling slightly appalled by the amount of people she once knew, whom she now no longer thinks about. It's Susie, or Sally, or Sandy, something like that. She flicks faster and faster. And then she suddenly stops. A pink post-it, clinging to the S page. Her own scratchy, hurried writing on it. And the words, Noelle Donnelly. And a number. And then she remembers. Sally. Yes, it was Sally. She remembers calling her one morning, saying, Ellie wants a tutor. You had a good one, didn't you? Have you got her number? Scribbling it down, pulling it off. Sticking it down. Thanks, Sal. You're a star. See you soon. The sound of her dogs barking in the background. She phones the number. Remarkably, someone answers. It's a young man with an Irish accent. Hello, says Laurel. Sorry to disturb you, but I'm looking for someone who used to be on this number. Noelle Donnelly.
Ah, right, yeah, says the young man.
Noelle's my auntie, but no one knows where she is.
Laurel is speechless for a second. She'd expected an unavailable tone. At the most, she'd expected someone who'd never heard of Noelle Donnelly. But here was a blood relative.
Oh, she says. Right. Yes, she disappeared, didn't she?
So they say, says the boy. So they say.
I wondered, Laurel begins. I've become quite friendly with Noelle's daughter, and Noelle's ex. And there's...
How could she phrase this?
There's things I'm not sure about. About her leaving. Could I come and see you?
Who are you? Did you say?
I'm a friend of Poppy's.
Ah, right. The girl she had. My grandma talks about her sometimes.
There's a brief silence, and Laurel wonders if he heard her asking to come over. But then he says,
Sure. Why not? It's number 12 Harlow Road. Just off Stroud Green Road.
Now, she confirms. I can come now.
Sure, he says. My name's Joshua, by the way. Joshua Donnelly.
And I'm Laurel Mack, she says. I'll be there in about half an hour.
Harlow Road is a turning off the high road, a section of the road that Laurel is more than familiar with, after watching the CCTV footage from the day Ellie disappeared so many times on the news. It's exactly opposite the spot where the car had been parked, the one whose windows Ellie had checked her reflection in. Number 12 is close to the turning. It's a tiny house in a terrace of other tiny houses, with a small cherry tree in the front garden. The house is in a bad state. It looks almost as though nobody lives there. Joshua Donnelly opens the door wide and steps aside.
"Come in, Laura," he says. "Come in."
"It's Laurel," she says. "Like the wreath?"
"Oh, sure. Like the wreath, yeah."
He pulls the door closed behind her. He's small and bouncy in oversized jersey joggers and a red and white football shirt. His hair is cut very short and has a small line shaved into it from the hairline. He has an appealing face, almost pretty, and very long eyelashes.
"You'll have to excuse the state of the place," he says, leading her into the tiny front room. "It's just me and my brother here, and we're not very domesticated."
The room is furnished with two brown leather sofas and lots of varnished pine furniture. On the walls are framed prints of modern art. Clothes are hanging to dry by the back door and over the backs of chairs. There are some mugs here and there and piles of what looks like college work. But it's not so bad, considering.
"So you're the sons of Noel's?"
"Younger brother. Yeah. There's four of them. Four brothers. And there were two girls, but one of them died when she was tiny, and the other one was Noel, and God knows what happened to her."
He takes some textbooks off a sofa and brushes some crumbs onto the floor with the side of his hand, gesturing to Laurel to take a seat.
"Can I get you anything? Tea? A Coke?"
She sits. "No, no, I'm fine, thank you."
"Are you sure? It's no bother."
"Honestly, thank you."
He clears space for himself on the other sofa and sits down, his knees spread wide, one leg jigging up and down.
"Did you inherit this place from Noel?"
she asks.
"Well, no, I wouldn't say inherited. The family just kind of absorbed it, you know? It's like our personal little hotel for anyone in the family who needs a place in London. And right now, that's me and Sammy, my kid brother."
"How long have you been here?"
"Since October. I've just started on a degree at Goldsmiths. I'll be here for a few years yet. But there were others here before me. I mean, there are 13 of us cousins. But we're not allowed to move anything or touch anything. You know what I mean? We have to keep it as she left it. More or less."
"In case she comes back?"
"Yeah. Sure, in case she comes back, exactly."
"And do you think she will?"
"Ah."
He shrugs.
"That's a question. You know, I never met her. None of us did, us cousins. She was like a ghost member of the family. We'd hear things about her, that she was buying herself a house, that she'd got together with a famous writer, that she was expecting a baby, all of that, but we never ever met her. Isn't that crazy?"
He blinks at her, his mouth set into a wide, smiling circle. And Laurel agrees.
"Yes," she says. "Yes, that is crazy."
She looks around the room at the pine shelves full of books and the sun-bleached prints on the walls.
"So all this," she says, "the furniture and the books, this is all Noel's?"
"Yeah. Yeah, all of it. I mean, upstairs, in the wardrobes. All her clothes are still there. Seriously. All her underwear and her bits and pieces."
"And no one ever packed anything away? It's all as she left it?"
"Yeah. Pretty much."
Laurel feels a shocking urge to run upstairs now and rifle through everything. To upend drawers and search through paperwork. For what? She wonders. What is it she thinks she will find?
"What do you think happened to your aunt?"
she asks instead.
"I genuinely don't have a clue. I mean, she was supposed to be coming over to Ireland, That's what I was told.
And she took her things. Her passport, her cards. She packed a bag, some photos. She was clearly going somewhere. But wherever it was, it looks like maybe she never got there. Her passport was never used. She hasn't used her cash card for years. He turns his hands, palms upward, and then places them on his knees.
Strange shit.
You know, Laurel says lightly, my daughter disappeared.
Oh, yeah.
Joshua sits forward, his interest piqued. She disappeared in 2005, and the last place my daughter was seen alive was there. She points towards Stroud Green Road. Just there, opposite the Red Cross shop, on CCTV. He narrows his eyes at her and they sit in silence for a moment. Laurel wonders how far she can push this personable young man before he goes on the defense. Poppy, she says. Your cousin. Have you met her?
No. None of us has. She's the only cousin we haven't met. And it's a shame because I have another cousin about her age. Clara. She's a laugh. She really is such a character. And maybe they could have been friends. But that guy. The writer guy.
Floyd.
Yeah. That's the guy. He keeps himself to himself and he keeps her close to home. He didn't want to know when we suggested we could help out with her care. I think one of my uncles went round there. You know, about a year after Noelle disappeared. Tried to make a friendship.
He shakes his head.
Apparently he was quite sharp with him. Made it clear that we weren't wanted.
Laurel wonders if Poppy even knows about her Irish family.
How do you know about them, then, Poppy and Floyd?
Asks Joshua. I'm in a relationship with Floyd, actually. He's my boyfriend.
Oh.
He raises his brow.
Right.
And funnily enough, Noelle used to tutor my daughter, Ellie. In fact, she was tutoring her in the weeks before she disappeared.
What? Here?
He points at the floor. No, Noelle came to my house, about half a mile from here.
Right,
he says.
Right.
Laurel gazes at him for a moment, willing him to provide her with the strand that will unfurl the knot of threads in her head.
So, are you saying that something untoward happened?
He says, eventually.
Is that what you're saying?
I don't know, Laurel says. I really don't know.
It does sound a bit odd, he says. I'll grant you that.
He puts his elbows on his knees and stares at the floor for a moment.
You've got me thinking now. Got my brain ticking over.
He circles his temple with his fingertip.
You have a mystery, and I have a mystery. And you think that maybe the two mysteries are connected?
Have you been through Noelle's things?
She asks.
Her private things. Diaries or such.
No. I never did, but there was...
He pauses.
There was one thing. A really strange thing. We could never quite fathom it.
He looks toward the door and then back again. He sighs.
Shall I show you?
What?
You'll have to trust me, because I'm a stranger to you and I could be anyone.
What do you mean?
Well, it's in the basement.
What is?
The strange thing. The thing we found. In the basement.
Laurel feels a surge of adrenaline. She looks at the boy with the sweet face sitting opposite her.
I totally understand if you don't want to go down. I wouldn't if I were you. Probably seen too many scary movies. You know, the ones where you go, don't go down into the basement, you bloody idiot.
He smiles, and he couldn't look more like a nice young man over from Ireland to do a degree.
I could just describe it if you like. Or I can go down and take a photo on my phone for you. Would that be a better idea?
She smiles. It's fine. I'll go and have a look.
Text someone,
he says, still looking anxiously at her.
Text someone to say where you are. That's what I would do.
She laughs.
Just show me,
she says. The door to the basement is in the kitchen. Joshua takes a torch from a drawer and leads her down a set of wooden steps. At the bottom is a door. He pushes it open into a small square room, completely clad in the same heavily varnished pine as the living room and the kitchen. There's a small window set high into the wall that frames the thin bare branches of the cherry tree in the front garden. There's a small sofa pulled out into a bed, a TV set, and a chair. And there's a series of what looks like hamster cages, piled up one on top of the other, on a table against the far wall. Joshua sweeps the torchlight across them.
There were like 20-odd hamsters in those when my uncles came. And they were all dead, you know, on their backs with their little legs in the air.
He mimes a dead hamster lying on its back with its legs in the air.
Some of them had eaten each other, apparently. We couldn't work it out at all. We thought maybe she'd been breeding them, you know, selling them to kids. But we couldn't find any evidence of that. It's just like, why would you have all those animals in your basement and then just leave them to die?
Laurel looks at the cages and shudders. Then she looks around again. In spite of the honey-coloured cladding, the room feels bare and cold. And there's something else, something chilling and unnerving in the very air of the room.
What do you think this room was for?
She asks, turning to examine the locks on the door, three of them in total, then turning again to look at the high window, the bare branches of the tree, the open sofa bed, the TV.
A guest room, I suppose.
It's not very homey, is it?
No. I don't suppose she had many guests. From all accounts, she was a bit antisocial.
So why would she have kept a sofa bed down here? And the TV? And all the animals that she left to die?
I told you, didn't I? I told you it was weird.
To be honest, I think my Auntie Noelle was probably all-round weird, full stop. We think losing her sister at such a young age damaged her, you know?
Laurel shivers again. She thinks of Hannah losing Ellie. She thinks of Hannah's dark, soulless flat. She thinks of her humourless persona, her awkward hugs. She feels a surge of panic that her daughter might end up like Noelle Donnelly, hoarding hamsters and then disappearing, leaving behind nothing but shadows in her wake. And as she thinks all this, her eye is caught by something poking out from under the sofa bed. Something small and plasticky. She reaches down to pick it up. It's a lip balm in a bright pink and green casing. It's watermelon flavored. She turns it over in the palm of her hand, and then she puts it into her pocket. For some reason, she feels that it belongs to her. Laurel's hands shake against the steering wheel as she drives home. She can still smell the basement room at Noelle Donnelly's house, the damp wood, the rotting carpet. Every time she closes her eyes, she sees the ugly sofa bed, the piles of hamster cages, the dirty window set high in the wall. When she gets home, she goes to her spare room and pulls out Ellie's box from under the bed once again. She rakes through pens and badges and rings and hair clips. Ellie's toothbrush is in the box, and Ellie's hairbrush, along with tangles of elastic bands and key rings and face creams. And there, in the mix, is a selection of lip balms. Three of them. One is papaya-flavored, one is mango-flavored, and the other is honeydew melon. She pulls the watermelon lip balm from Noelle's basement from the pocket of her coat and lines it up with the others. It forms a set. Chapter 31.
Yes, it's true that I told you I'd gone on the pill when that wasn't strictly the case. In all honesty, I thought I was too old anyway, and did not expect to get pregnant literally 2 months after we stopped using condoms. It was all over the papers at the time, how your eggs all dried up and fell out on your 35th birthday, and genuinely, when my period was late, I thought that was it. I thought I'd had my menopause. It wasn't until my jeans started getting a little tight that it occurred to me to check. So I bought a test, and I got the little pink lines and sat there on the toilet in my house, rocking back and forth, and having a little cry. Because suddenly I thought, I didn't really want a baby after all. Suddenly I realized I'd been an idiot, and a fool. How could I raise a child? Me, with no maternal instincts. Me, with my baby-scaring face. And how did I know that you'd even want it? Yes, you'd said the thing that you said, but I had no idea how you'd react. Not really. But when I told you, you were happy. At least, you weren't unhappy. Well, you said, that's a curveball. And then you said, do you want to keep it? As though it was a necklace I'd bought myself that I might just take back to the shop. I said, well, of course I want to keep it. It's ours. And you nodded. And that was that. Except you also said, I can't ask you to live with me. You know that. That hurt me, but I didn't show it. I just said, no, of course not. As though the thought had never occurred to me. And to be truthful, I did think you'd change your mind once you met the baby. So I never said what I really thought, which was that I couldn't possibly raise a baby by myself. I'd missed two periods, but wasn't sure how far along I might be. He came with me for my scan. I remember that day. It was a nice day. He held my hand in the waiting room. We were both a little giddy, with nerves no doubt, but also I think with excitement. It felt like one of those days that you have sometimes in life, where you feel like you've reached a branch in the road, that you're setting off on a new journey, suitcases packed, full of trepidation and anticipation. The day felt clean and new, disconnected to the days that had come before and to the days that would follow. I have never felt as close to another human being as I felt to you that day, Floyd. Never. And then there was the screen with the tadpole, and I felt your hand tighten around mine and you were thrilled. I know you were. There was your child inside me. A human being who would come into our lives and who would never tell you that they hated you. A chance to start again. A chance to get it all right. You were happy in that moment. You were, Floyd. You were. But there was no noise. No noise. I had never been pregnant before. I thought maybe the heart hadn't been formed yet. Or that maybe it was my heartbeat that kept the tadpole alive. I didn't even know. I didn't know that even at this size, 10 weeks along, the clinician said, there should be a heartbeat. How was I supposed to know? But you looked at the clinician as she moved the monitor around my belly, the smile fading from her face. And you said, is there a problem? And she said,
I'm having a little trouble locating a heartbeat.
And then I knew, too. I knew that there should have been a noise, and that there wasn't. Your hand came away from my hand. You sighed. And it wasn't a sigh of sadness. It wasn't even a sigh of disappointment. It was a sigh of annoyance. A sigh that said, "You couldn't even do this properly, could you?" More even than the lost baby. That sigh virtually killed me.
After that, you made it clear that this could be our chance to walk away from each other. No hard feelings. But you weren't strong-minded enough just to end it, and I took advantage of that. I lingered on, yes, I'll admit that. I overstayed my welcome. I reverted 100% to the person I'd been before I was pregnant. I came to your house at your command for sex. I even moved in for a few months when they were doing the damp in my house. I knew you didn't really want me there. "Have they said how much longer?" he'd ask. "The builders. Do you have a date yet?" So I knew nothing had really changed, and I didn't pretend to lay any special claim to you and your time just because my womb had once hosted your tadpole. And there was your terrible child, Sarah Jade, hating you and needing you in equal measure, confusing you and upsetting you, hitting you and spitting at you, then refusing to get off your lap for half an hour when you had things you needed to do. And there was my womb, touched so briefly by unexpected life, echoing with the unheard heartbeat of our dead baby. And I couldn't make sense of it all. You'd gone back to the condoms as I was clearly not to be trusted. So there would not be a baby for you and me. And I needed to accept that. I tried really hard to accept it, Floyd. Really hard. I tried for 2 years. I turned 43. And then I turned 44. And then you started taking chances. Thinking probably that I was all out of eggs and... One night you ran out of condoms and said, "Never mind, I'll just pull out." Well, clearly you did not pull out fast enough or early enough, and it happened all over again. I missed a period. I took a test. 2 pink lines appeared. For 3 days I felt like I was sitting on the crest of a wave, the sun shining on my face, the wind in my hair, angels playing on harps wherever I went. I booked a scan, but this time I didn't tell you. I could not have borne the quiet room, the sigh of annoyance, the dropped hand. But before I could even make it to the clinic, your baby had died and fallen out of me. A small bleed. I'd have thought it was a heavy period if I hadn't taken the test. I cancelled the appointment. I never told you about the second tadpole. And it was that day, Floyd. It was that very day that I first went to the home of Ellie Mac. The same day your baby died inside me, I had to slap on a smile and a friendly disposition and sit in a room with a spoiled pretty girl and a hairy cat, surrounded by the paraphernalia of family life. The photos and the kicked-off shoes, the trashy paperbacks and the furniture all from Habitat, no doubt. And I had to teach this spoiled, pretty girl with a brain too big for her own good, who already knew everything she needed to know, when what I really wanted to do was sob and say, "Today I lost another baby." But I did not. No. I drank her mother's lovely tea from a mug with the words, "Keep calm and clean my kitchen," on it. I ate her nice chocolate chip biscuits made by Prince Charles himself. I taught her daughter a good lesson. I worked hard for my £35. I felt calm when I left Ellie Mac's house that evening. I walked the half mile home and it was a cold, sharp evening, with drops of ice in the air that stung the backs of my hands. I walked slowly, relishing the darkness and the pain. And as I walked, I felt this certainty build within me. A certainty that somehow it was all connected. The gone baby and the spoiled girl. That there was a conflation, that maybe one thing balanced out the other.
I got home and I didn't call you or look at my phone to see if you had called me. I watched a TV show and I cut my toenails. I drank a glass of wine. I had a long, long bath. I let the water rush up between my legs, washing away the last traces of your baby. And I thought of the girl called Ellie Mack, of her big brain and her perfect features, the honey of her hair tied so carelessly into a topknot, the socked feet tucked beneath her, and elegant hands folded into her sleeves. The smell of her, of apples and toothpaste, of clean hair and girl. The keenness to learn, her gentleness, her perfection. She had a glow about her, a circle of light. I bet she never told her parents she hated them. I bet she never spat at them, or pinched them, or threw her food across the room. She was quite, quite lovely, and quite, quite brilliant. And I have to confess, I became, more than a little, obsessed.
Chapter 32. Later that day, Laurel visits her mother, Ruby. "Still here?" she asks, placing her handbag on the floor and slipping off her coat. Ruby tuts and sighs.
"Looks like it."
Laurel smiles and takes her hand. "We drank a toast to you on Friday," she says. "At the birthday party? We all miss you very much."
Ruby rolls her eyes, as if to say, "Sure you did."
"We really did. And guess what? I met Bonnie."
Ruby's eyes open wide, and she puts her fingertips to her mouth.
Wow.
Yes, wow.
"She's nice. I knew she would be. Cuddly."
"Fat."
Laurel laughs.
"No, not fat.
Just bosomy."
Ruby looks down at her own flat chest, the same flat chest that she bequeathed to her daughter, and they both laugh.
Boyfriend. All happy?
"Yes," she replies with more positivity than she's feeling. Her mother has extended her miserable existence beyond the point of comfort to see her daughter happy. "Really happy. It's going really well." She sees a question pass across her mother's eyes, and she moves the conversation along quickly. Asks after her health, her appetite, if she's heard anything from her hopeless brother, who moved to Dubai the same day Ruby moved into the home.
"I won't see you again,"
her mother says, as Laurel puts on her coat. Laurel looks at her, looks deep into her eyes. Then she leans down and holds her in her arms, puts her mouth to her ear and says, "I will see you next week, Mum. And if I don't, then I want you to know that you have been the best and most amazing mother in the world. And I have been extraordinarily lucky to have you for so long. And that I adore you. And that we all do. And that you could not have been any better than you were. Okay." She feels her mother's head nodding against hers, the soft puff of her hair, like a breath against her cheek.
"Yes,"
says her mother.
"Yes. Yes. Yes."
Laurel wipes tears from her cheek and puts on a smile before pulling away from her mother. "Bye, Mum," she says. "I love you."
"I love you. Too."
Laurel stops in the doorway for a second and looks at her mother, absorbs the shape of her and the exquisite feeling of her existence in the world. Then she sits in her car for a moment afterward, in the car park, She allows herself to cry for about 30 seconds, and then talks herself out of it. Wanting to die and dying are generally unrelated. But this felt like more than